You have tuned in to an encore presentation of Cascadia News Now on KMRE 102.3 FM. Thanks so much for listening. An ear on the world around Bellingham, Whatcom, and beyond. I'm Stephanie Contouris with your co-host, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson, host producer of American Carnage Report, Dave Willingham, and our special guest host tonight, County Councilman Barry Buchanan. Welcome, Barry.
Well, hi, Stephanie. Thanks for having me on tonight. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. And we have so much to talk about on the docket. Councilman Buchanan is going to be talking about the present and future of Cherry Point and the county jail. Bellingham City Council races get more interesting. And yes, our weekly love letter to Attorney General Bob Ferguson all ahead. But first, $136. $136 is the magic number, and that is the fine that we will be paying for driving while distracted. As announced by Governor Jay Inslee, this law was supposed to go into effect about 9 months from now, and in a pretty dramatic reveal, the governor announced that it is in place in 90 days.
Yeah, this was one of the very few vetoes we've gotten, substantial vetoes, from Jay Inslee this year, and really, this deserves it. There was a study 2 years ago that estimated that at about any given time, 7% of drivers on the roads in Washington State are distracted by some device, and this would prevent, you know, holding a device in your hand, playing with one on the seat, anything other than an incidental tap, even if you're stopped at a stoplight. I think, and it makes using a device while driving a offense that a police officer can stop you for. Right now, they're just secondary things, so they can't stop you for it. But if your taillight's out and you're on the phone, they can pop you for that. But
and let me just clarify, when you say veto, so what that meant was that the law that was sent to Governor Inslee's desk was to go into place in 9 months. The veto part was only that he took out the 9 months. And so he didn't veto the whole law. He let the whole law go forward just a lot faster.
Right. Yes. He felt it was important enough to get rid of the delay.
And so one aspect that is important is that you can be stopped, as you said, Dave, visually if an officer sees you picking up your phone. Now, remember, a lot of us use our phones for navigation. I do not believe in texting and driving, but I have been known to, like, nudge my phone to make Google tell me where to go next. You can put your phone on one of those holder devices that you can attach to your dashboard, a dashboard clip. You can pull over and get yourself your directions going, get your navigator going. You can use Bluetooth, but you can't actually hold your phone. If an officer sees you through the window holding your phone, that is $136. And as you said, not only can a police officer pull you over, the other hidden part of this is that they can send this information to your insurance company. So this is a good thing to pay attention to. The announcement was pretty impactful. A lot of people who had relatives killed through their own or other people's use of phones were there at, I think it was the Tacoma Police Center. And it's good for you to be aware of. So driving while distracted. Also relating to this law is a new DWI, driving under the influence. It used to be a felony if it happened to you five times. Now a felony if it happens to you four times. So going from that into the other thing that happened with Governor Inslee this week is that he announced a special session. The reason that this is surprising or unusual or unfortunate is because it is not his first announcement of a special session this year.
Yeah, we're in round two, and really now at the end of the first special session, we don't have a lot to show for it. It has not been tremendously productive. The only things that are routinely happening are four members of the state legislature are meeting regularly to discuss McCleary fixes. They are still waiting for...
Let's unpack McCleary a little bit, just in case people hadn't listened to us in a previous week.
It's the total reformulation of the way we currently pay for education in this state. And there are two competing plans, one from the Democratic House, one from the Republican Senate, with fairly divergent ways to pay for it and plans of action. So negotiations are ongoing for that. The big ticket item is still the budget that nobody's really talking about right now. And it's, frankly, it's very disappointing. But I have seen a rash of editorials around the state this week. People are starting to pay attention, starting to get disappointed, trying to avoid the triple special session that we had in 2015.
Well, Dave, I was hoping that you would be able to share with us some of Senator Kevin Ranker's annoyance and anger about the particular situation. And you'd said on an earlier show, and I think it's worth unpacking again, that on the Republican side, I mean, the person that's running this thing is Dino Rossi, and he really has no dog in the hunt. He's not up for election. He's not going to be up for election. He's in there in a temporary situation, and so he's playing a very aggressive political game. And he's got no skin in the game.
And I think wasn't elected.
Right. I think it's fair to say Rossi was appointed, absolutely. And I think it's fair to say that Ranker is not the only senator who is irate at what's happening, but he has certainly been very vocal. He has an op-ed, as you were referring to, Tim, in the Seattle Times today that is really worth looking at. The line that I took from that op-ed is, we need to finish what the people sent us here to do.
And he is the ranking Democrat that writes the budget. So he's at ground zero on this. I sense and I share his frustration with the long trip to Olympia, day after day after day. And here we are going into a second special session, delay upon delay. And it, in his words, it's not good government.
And I'm curious, Barry, we know what we're paying an inordinate amount for per diem rate for us to be in a second special session. We know what's happening on the state level. But how do you see it impacting us on the county level?
Well, it certainly impacts us on the Hearst decision. The county is eagerly waiting a decision out of the legislature on how to proceed with mitigation plans and everything around exempt wells out in the county. So we're frustrated, and we're really looking for some answers to come out of this. We hope the first special session, obviously, but again, that didn't happen, and we're looking for some sort of resolution this second special session.
And what about education? How might our county be impacted by how the winds are blowing?
Well, education affects everyone. It affects all counties, affects all cities, and affects certainly all of our kids and parents. So, you know, it's really important that we get this straightened out and we get something in place that's fair for our teachers and for our kids.
You know, I want to talk about that Hearst thing for a second. This decision, and hopefully there will be some further discussion on it, but I really am starting to feel like there isn't the political will on all sides to get a real resolution through. I think we've already seen a couple of Republican legislators on Twitter talking about, we're trying, but nobody will talk to us about Hearst, which is absurd because they're not negotiating for the budget, so they're not really doing anything.
And can we just have a quick callback to when we got into the session, there was that... this isn't about Hearst so much as about the McCleary. So Hearst is about the wells, McCleary is about education. That there was a committee that was sent off to find some answers, and you had said came back with nothing.
Yeah, the state legislature last year set up a committee that would spend 7 months working on plans, and the Republicans said, we're going to work on our plan. Democrats said, we're going to work on our plan. When they reconvened, only one side brought a plan. The other had a PowerPoint about their intention to make a plan. And, you know, this is, again, state Republicans not quite playing the same game as everybody else is.
And I also sense that these are two extremely important things for Washington State and Washington counties, a decision about water planning in the state of Washington, a plan about funding education. And so you can extract and exact a lot of pain and a lot of pressure by holding these things hostage to the bigger negotiation about budget. And I think that some of that's happening too. I mean, if they were to make an agreement on these two things, they would lose a lot of their leveraging power in trying to extract pain from the opposite party.
Yeah, I agree with you, Tim. I think that, you know, the Republican theory is let's go back to pre-GMA type of
growth management.
Non-growth management. And the Democrats favor a mitigation plan that we can mitigate how it affects our surrounding tributaries and in-stream flows. So I think, you know, that's that dichotomy in philosophies between the Democrats and the Republicans.
And going back to what you said, Tim, about Kevin Ranker and some of his hire, he has talked again and again about the larger issue of how do we resolve our budget issues. And we have some mandates in our state. 60% of our constitution, 60% of our budget is firm, and so we're doing or trying to do more and more with less and less. And what Senator Ranker tends to point out is that the Republican solution is about property taxes, and the Democratic solution is about business tax and caps of higher wages. And so I think that what you're getting at is true for Hearst, it's true for McCleary, but there's this larger ideological fight with an immovable object and an irresistible force. And so we're back again and again and again. And what Senator Ranker's op-ed piece talked about was the art of compromise, which we see on a national scale, which is outside of our scope, but we are also seeing, I think, increasingly on a state scale.
Well, I think the thing that gets lost a little bit on the history is that in 2007, 2008, Washington State cut $5 billion out of its budget. That was never replaced. And so the idea that out there is like, well, we can cut and we can cut some more. It's like, you know, they cut and they cut pretty severely.
Right.
And, if you're a Republican, you like small government, you like low taxes. So in some ways, Republicans have gotten everything they wanted. They've got a state budget that's $5 billion less, and now they want to say that they don't need any extra revenue for education. But I think it's pretty obvious that they do need extra revenue. And so then the question becomes, well, what sources of revenue might we agree to that are agreeable and that are equitable, and so that we're not constantly hitting property owners with property taxes or consumers with sales taxes. There are other mechanisms and instruments, but we can't ever get past this impasse.
Well, because it's so much easier to just say no and say that you did something. And this has become a generational problem in this state. And we're not going to have as good a overall state as we do now unless we get serious about how we're going to pay for all of this stuff, how we're going to pay for education, how we're going to keep the lights on, how we're going to keep, you know, water flowing. And it's just too much fun to play the game for some folks.
Well, that's part of it, and I think your points and I think Tim's points are excellent. Thank you for the history lesson and reminder, Tim. I think it's absolutely crucial to look at where we are now in the context of we have cut down to the bone, and some of our representatives have been saying that year after year. The other aspect of that, and I know nobody likes to talk about it, is the way that we tax in this state. Some of us have said over and over again, it has been evaluated that we are the most regressive, the least progressive tax structure in the country.
By far.
By far, because we're taxed on what we pay for, but not on what people earn. So there's no equality there. And it's a conversation that I've asked legislators, I've asked state legislators, when are we going to have it? And for the exact same reasons that you said, Dave, it's way easier to say no. It's way easy to argue, and it's way easier for me to argue for a heart issue like, please, let's let bathrooms be open to whoever needs to use them so people aren't bullied. That's an easy issue. It's a heart issue. But if you get into, hey, I'm running on this tax structure revisioning, like, boom, you've lost interest. People don't want to hear it. They don't want to pay a state income tax.
Well, I go to this well a lot, but Lenin had this idea of heightening the contradictions. You make capitalism's bad parts so bad that people will eventually have to turn to communism. And I feel like we're kind of in something similar with that now. If we can make government so bad that everyone will turn against it, some people think that's a win for them. But that costs us dearly. We're already paying a tremendous amount of fines to no one knows who for our poor education funding. You know, our roads are falling apart. Our bridges are falling down. We have to take this seriously.
Yeah, and in speaking of that, this is the anniversary of the collapse of the Skagit River Bridge a couple of years ago. I mean, I think it happened almost exactly at this time. You know, no one was injured in that, but it's a miracle that no one was injured. I mean, a major freeway bridge collapsed into Skagit River due to a lack of maintenance, lack of repair, and the state's bridges are in infrastructure is in total disastrous disrepair. So here we are stuck talking about education, and all that gets put, you know, off into the future.
Absolutely. And based on what you said, Dave, I'd just like to say that the views expressed by Cascadia News Now are not necessarily those of KMRE or Spark Museum, and we're not necessarily advocating communism either. But we'll have some conversations about what we do advocate when we put our eye on Barry on Cherry and get back into Cherry Point Refinery right after this.
Community to Community Development is your local grassroots organization led by women, people of color, and farm workers.
Comunidad a Comunidad es su organización local de base que es liderada por mujeres, personas de color, y campesinos.
If you care about the food that you eat and having a fair and sustainable food system, you should partner with us.
Si le importa la comida que comemos y quiere mejorar el sistema alimentario, debería juntarse con nosotros.
You can call us at 360-738-0893 or you can find us on the Facebook.
Puede comunicarse con nosotros por teléfono 360-738-0893 o encontrarnos en nuestra página de Facebook.
You are tuned to Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris with Tim Johnson, Dave Willingham, and Whatcom County Councilman Barry Buchanan. And we want to talk, since you're here, about the Cherry Point amendments that were just approved after maybe one of the longest sessions of County Council. Is that true?
It's possible. It went until, with all the other business we had afterwards, it went till 12:50. So 10 minutes to 1 a.m.
That's not in the brochure for a county council person.
No, it isn't.
Should we warn the people who are running? Then we were talking last week about I wonder if some of the participation and citizen activism is a result of what's happening on a national level. Do you see I mean, this isn't typical, but do you see in general more citizen activism at meetings?
Absolutely. At some of our public hearings leading up to this last one, one of the common phrases we heard was, with the federal government in the situation it is at right now, you are our last line of defense. And I take that to heart because I kind of came up with that myself after the election. I knew it was going to be tough to get federal grants. So much of what we do is from federal and state level grants, and EPA plays a big part in a lot of our water programs. So I think the activism has increased by quite a bit because of, well, look at the Women's March. Bellingham put in over 10,000 people in the streets. It was amazing. And it's very obvious to me that the activism here has shot up since this administration has taken over.
Well, Barry, maybe you can talk about the Cherry Point amendments. Maybe you can describe them, what they were trying to do, and why that got people riled up on all sides and got people out talking to you about them.
Sure. Well, it started last summer when they were proposed, and the basic premise was to discourage and to not allow, I should say, unrefined fossil fuel exports out of Cherry Point.
Why is that important?
That's important because of many factors, one being the public safety and the transportation issues that we have. We have coal trains going through Bellingham. We have oil trains going through Bellingham. We've had numerous instances throughout the world, not just the country, internationally, in Canada, the United States, of exploding rail cars. So that was a big issue for us, was protecting the public from those types of things. The other thing that a lot gets lost on a lot of people is the jobs. If we start becoming just a pure export terminal out of Cherry Point, we lose those good refining jobs that we have spent decades building. And I know I've had a lot of my relatives work in those refining jobs, and they can't be replaced. I mean, you can't just have a push-button operation to load crude onto tankers and expect that to be any kind of an economic boom for our economy here.
Well, hold up, because there are certainly people in the county who believe that this moratorium in your future plans actually itself cuts jobs. And what you're saying is you're talking about a certain kind of push button, like auto mechanized job. How do the refinery jobs then get lost?
Well, the refinery jobs get lost because there's no more there's no work for finished products, because it's being shipped overseas to operations, say, in Asia, that have no or little environmental regulation as far as how they operate. And those jobs will go there because they'll be pennies on the dollar. So it's a corporate advantage type of situation where they can find cheaper labor overseas. You hear people talk all the time about, let's don't ship our jobs overseas. Well, this is a good example of how that can happen. And if you took a look at the people that came out to testify at our last meeting, it was from the industry. It was all upper management. Which tells me something.
Maybe you can talk a bit about the study that the council also authorized, the $150,000 study. What is the hope of the council in authorizing that study, and when do you expect the results of that?
Well, as we move forward into the next phase, which would be looking at actual code to implement these ideas from the comp plan, we need to have a legal opinion of where the county's authority begins and ends. So things like the Commerce Clause, all kinds of things that actually Mr. Sidhu mentioned about, who insures rail cars and the safety of that operation. The number of questions that'll come up will be huge.
And this is kind of an issue of federal control of a lot of this transportation, commerce, all of this. And its impacts descending down to local government, where there is not a lot of policy, there's not a lot of law or regulation at the county level.
Absolutely, we have to kind of find out how land use can play into this and still pass muster with some of the federal laws.
So you could kind of say that the Cherry Point amendments are sort of like aspirational goals for the county, and those need to be put into place in actual law at some point.
Correct. And we don't want to do that in a vacuum. We want to be able to have good, sound legal and other, professional advice as far as, what our authority is and what kind of things that we can regulate and what kind of things we can't.
So I don't want to put you on the spot in terms of the hats you wear, but in terms of, if you can't answer this, that's fine. But in terms of the redistricting of the county, how have you thought about how the changing nature of the county council might impact the future of Cherry Point and future decisions that are made?
Well, certainly majorities on any legislative body control the your how you what sausage you make, correct?
Right.
So, you know, the five districts really favor progressives, but not by much. If you take two districts in Bellingham that are pretty solidly progressive, you take a third district, which is the foothills, which is kind of either way. There's some unknowns there. And, of course, the coastal district, which is another one that can be swing. But we have tended to do well in the coastal district.
So listeners know, that's Blaine and Ferndale.
Yes. Okay. And then there's a new one called the Farmland District, which is basically Linden. So we can expect that to be, you know, pretty much a conservative seat. So, you know, there'll be some fights to maintain the at-large seats, which are countywide, and there's two of them now. We've traditionally seen that at-large voting in Whatcom County is very much of a pendulum. It goes with, you know, the biggest voice in the biggest political voice of the time.
Right. But, I think, so in terms of getting things done, in terms of you're a company, Whatcom County, the company, gets things done, that might be hampering, the new districts might be hampering, but in terms of bringing different perspectives to the table, I'm hoping that, I guess idealistically, I'm hoping that it could be a positive.
I would hope so, too. I agree with you, because I know when we had a conservative member who resigned, it was always good to have that perspective in your dialogue, to be able to have something to compare things against, right? And to be able to hear different points of view in order to formulate your own ideas and your final decisions.
So to go back a little bit to the study about Cherry Point and to determine kind of the county's role and authority here, is there any concern that what might come back is the county doesn't have any say over what gets shipped out of here anymore?
We think that we've done a pretty good high-level vetting of some of the questions that you're asking. I think it's some of the more minor details that we're not sure of. And again, some of those questions haven't even been thought of yet. As we go through the process, I think we will. But I think I feel pretty good about the fact that we can limit the number of peers, that we can discourage and not allow permitting of large projects that are used to export unrefined fossil fuels. So I think we have pretty solid ground there. It's just some of the incidentals that are going to go along with that. That again, like I said, we don't even know what some of those may be at this point. But we need to come up with an exhaustive list and have a good discussion legally and with experts in the field.
So we want to also talk about the county jail, and that's another issue like Hearst, like education, that just sort of keeps coming back around. And we've talked about the planning and the meetings, and I'm kind of curious to know where you are and what your perspective is on us moving forward or not.
Well, I think we did two important things in the last 2 years. One of the most important was that we formed the Incarceration Prevention and Reduction Task Force, which began looking at alternatives to jail, programs that could be set up for diversion, and all the kinds of things that can help reduce our population. The other issue that was between the county and the city that was a sticking point was the financial arrangements. So I suggested that we come up with a work group of those jurisdictions involved that we could hammer out those details, putting aside the size of the jail, putting aside the stuff that the incarceration prevention.
Those are big things to put aside.
Yeah, well, we were asked to. Okay. And it was very difficult because you can't come up with a final number. So everything had to be scalable.
Wow.
In our thinking. And it worked. It did work pretty well. Because the county council ultimately is the body that's going to decide the size of the jail.
Right. And that was a question I was going to ask, because I was attending a city council meeting recently, and they said that any consideration of the size has been pulled out of the documents for discussion in terms of how it gets financed, because the county council has made it very clear that they want to be the deciding body on the size of the jail. How will you do that?
Well, I think everybody's, each council member is going to have their own kind of way of doing that, because it's very difficult. I've kind of come up with my own strategy, and that is the studies I've read have shown that counties that are larger, over 250,000, tend to have trajectories that are lower in as far as jail populations. Smaller counties that are under 250,000 tend to have a trajectory going the other way. And the analysis of that points out that its resources and policy are really more of a factor than actual population growth as far as jail population. So the more resources you can put into it and the more policy work you can do around prevention, the more you can change that trajectory from a growing jail population to a shrinking jail population.
And you are listening to KMRE FM 102.3 FM Bellingham, Cascadia News Now, with our guest host, County Councilman Barry Buchanan, also Dave Willingham, Tim Johnson, and I am Stephanie Contours. We are talking about the future of the county jail, and it seems like there's some people who are feeling a little bit better about where the direction's headed, and then I've certainly heard from some of our same voices in the county that are completely against moving forward on a jail.
Do you, Barry, point blank question, do you think it's going to go on a ballot for November?
I think that's going to be a close vote is what I think. So I can't tell you either way the way I think that's going to go, but I think it's a 4-3, that's the way it feels to me.
Do you think do you believe that the county can't, because I've talked to a couple of county council people and they're like, we haven't heard anything about it at all, one way or the other. It's like we've been living in a dark zone. Do you think that the county council feels fully informed to make the decision of whether to put it on a ballot?
Well, we have a couple of steps before that decision comes up. Our next meeting next week we'll be looking at the jail facility use agreement that talks about those financial arrangements.
Can you tell us a little bit more about?
The jail facility use agreement is how the different jurisdictions utilize and pay for their participation in using the jail. So, for instance, Blaine will have a certain percentage of what they kick in, and then what the per diems are also in there. The access to the jail is in the jail facility use agreement.
And that's been a hang up for Bellingham before.
Yes, and we've ironed that out, supposedly. I mean, their council hasn't looked at it either, but there was two council members and the mayor were on the work group, as well as two county council members and the executive. And people were pretty satisfied with the scalable model of the financing. And we're pretty happy with those proportions.
So, and I ask this over and over again, the whole jail process was broken into basically three sections. There was the size and scope, which is the county council. There was the financing it working group, and there was the alternatives program. And it seems to me that maybe that was a little over distributed. It seems like, and I know you're talking about the scalable model, but in determining how to pay for it, wouldn't it be important when you're looking at funding mechanisms to know what you're paying for?
Well, of course, yeah. You mean as far as the final, what hits the ballot, you mean? Or
I mean, in the whole process of designing, how are we going to build this? How are we going to pay for it? All of it. Wouldn't it be at the starting point that you would be like, this is what we want to build, and then this is what we're going to pay for it?
There's two ways to think of that. That's one way. The other way is, here's our budget, and with that budget, what can we build? So, you know, and I think that's kind of the approach we're looking at right now. We're kind of looking at what can everybody afford to pay for and what's their share. And then the county council has to take that information and come up with a number.
And I think one of the things that one of the concerns of the restorative justice community is that there's been great work on the incarceration alternatives, But a lot of those things have not been implemented. They're coming. And the idea is, the concern is that if we get a new jail, it kind of pulls the cork out of the bottle and takes the pressure off of our policymakers and our law enforcement professionals to implement those alternatives.
I totally agree with you, and that's the kind of the $64,000 question is, how do we take the work that they're doing and make that a variable in the formula? And we need to do that. And again, with not being able to, like you said, get the final reports out, that makes that tough.
So we will continue to have this conversation with Councilman Buchanan and other people. And I strongly encourage you, if you care about this issue at all, to reach out to your representatives, both city and county, because the process is slowly moving forward. And we are going to move forward ourselves and take a look at part two of our filing week candidates. Filing week ended on Friday, and the last day to withdraw was this Monday. And we are going to focus on city candidates. But we do have a quick update on a county race that Rudd Brown was running unopposed, and he is now opposed by Philip Morgan, who I know nothing about and did not respond to efforts to contact him or get a statement. So we look forward to hearing more about him. We were going to take a quick look at the five districts, but I think Barry, you and Tim have already done a really good job of explaining where those districts are and what they might look like. So let's get into the city races. We have Jean Knudsen and Pinky Vargas are unopposed, and that is final because filing week is closed. So the contested races are Ward 6, Michael Lilliquist and Quimby Peterson, and Council at Large, it's the big one, Roxanne Murphy, Jean Layton, and Eric Bostrom. Let's start with Michael Lilliquist, the incumbent, Quimby Peterson, who was just endorsed at the Young Democrats of Whatcom meeting. And Quimby is a school board director who was endorsed by the Green Party when she ran for school board. And in the Young Dems endorsement meeting, pretty much everybody else they endorsed was an incumbent.
It's interesting. I mean, first of all, those are excellent candidates. Michael Lilliquist, I think, has proven himself to be a very intelligent, thoughtful person on the council, has taken on some leadership positions. I think that it's great when very talented people step up. But what I see happening in this particular race is this is a continuation of the discussion between the Bernie Sanders progressives on one hand and the sort of the more establishment style candidates on the other side. And I think that the Young Democrats are asserting them in many of their endorsements are asserting themselves that they're into progressive change. They're not into business as usual. They want things to move forward on a variety of issues. And I think that they're fired up. And I think it's interesting to see.
Well, and it's an interesting district, it'll be interesting to see how things play out. I think that this is probably going to be kind of a harbinger. I think that there's been talk about Lilliquist's future political moves, and I think that this will really be kind of a overall referendum on him as a politician.
And where is Ward 2 exactly? Since you said it was an interesting district.
Ward 6.
Ward 6, sorry.
That's South Bellingham.
South Bellingham. Yeah. Very liberal.
Yes.
Very
liberal. When Lilliquist, the first race he won to take that seat, there were at least two other very liberal candidates in the
Catherine
primary.
Chambers. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember who else.
Yeah, I don't recall. Yeah. But yeah, it was a very, very liberal race.
It was. And Michael Lilliquist, very liberal candidate. Mm. Quimby, very liberal. It's interesting to see, our political system sometimes polarizes on extremes. But what's really interesting is in some of these races, like particularly this one, it's very nuanced. In terms of, and they will be looking at things that are pretty vital to the to the future of Bellingham. I think probably affordable housing is the one that I would throw up there. It's probably the central fight for the soul of Bellingham in the future is who gets to live here.
In terms of housing and maybe in terms of homelessness, which is our other ongoing issue that has been very sharply pointed out and divided in recent weeks in the city of Bellingham. So that'll be interesting to see. When you say that the young Dems were sort of taking a progressive stand, but I also think that in the at-large race that they endorsed Roxanne Murphy, if I'm not correct, and Jean Leighton is sort of seen as the progressive challenger of the Bernie slate, if you want to. I'm not saying that they want to be associated with Bernie, but maybe some of us sort of see them as coming out of that.
Yeah, and I think some of it has to do with Roxanne's status as a Native American person of color, strong woman on the council, and it's not necessarily I think the Young Democrats are not necessarily about kicking people out of office. It's just about holding candidates' feet to the fire to make sure that they are really on board with progressive issues. And this would be another race. This will be a primary race, but my sense is this will be another race that's highly nuanced because this one may be particularly talking about issues of affordable housing. So I think that's going to be the narrative of the Bellingham election. I think it's going to be a lot quieter and gentler and softer than the county races, but I do think that Bellingham's going to have an interesting conversation this fall.
Well, part of that is dependent on the other candidate in that race, who is a, Trump supporter, has been anti-gay, anti-immigrant, anti-minority publicly in town for some time. And it'll be interesting if they get any serious fundraising going and can throw up a lot of dirt.
Yeah, here's my prediction about that. Bellingham is a very, very nice town on the surface, and it's actually a kind of a nice town under the surface, but it's not quite as polite under the surface. And I think that this candidate that we're talking about is going to get a
Eric Bostrom. I'm just going to say it. Somebody has to say it. It's Roxanne Murphy, Jean Leighton, and Eric Bostrom are running for the council at large position.
He's going to get a very chilly reception, I think, across the board. From Bellingham, not simply because of his political positions, but because of the rancorous way that he presents himself and this confrontational way that he presents himself, and that it's just whatever you say about Bellingham, right, left, center, we're all pretty nice about things, and we don't like it when people are really nasty about things.
That's why we're the city of subdued excitement.
Correct.
Or the city of subdued hostility, as maybe Tim is implying. It's interesting that you say that. I think about when Clayton Petrie ran for office and ran for mayor, and that he certainly has libertarian, right-leaning values. But the race itself was respectful, and he is a great guy. He's a wonk, and he fit the Bellingham nice.
Right, and respect, I think, is a great word. I think that we in Bellingham we respect people who are respectful.
Mm-hmm. And Clayton is kind of an exceptional example because he is a very thoughtful man, and he's the sort of person that you can have a conversation with and disagree with. He is not one of those who thinks that going into someone else's space and being a jerk makes you a hero.
Right, or holding up signs on the street that are hostile. And he also spoke against sanctuary cities. He's one of the speakers at City Council against sanctuary cities. And what I think is interesting is how he may change the numbers in an otherwise more straightforward race between Roxanne Murphy and Jean Leighton. It's a weird race with those two to me, because one might say that Jean is the more progressive candidate, and yet it seems that Jean has some pretty strong feelings about housing and attached units and who can have all that kind of stuff and single family dwelling units and all of that. And so in some ways she's not as progressive. And at the same time, I've seen a lot of insiders party insiders when Eric Bostrom declared, sort of sneering about him and saying, well, Roxanne's not going to have any problem with him, as if Gene wasn't even in the race. So, man, I can see that they're like exactly what you said, Tim, that there's some under the surface snipiness that.
Well, there is. And you know, we glossed over it, but I'd like to return to it. Yeah. It's not surprising to me that Gene did not draw a challenger. I don't know if he's ever had a challenger. It's as long as he's been running, Gene Knudsen, and it's been like 24 years.
Stephen Trinkus ran against him.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. For 24 years, I think this is Gene's last term on the council, although that's what he said last time. but I actually was a little surprised that Pinky didn't draw a challenger, and mostly as a result of some of the irritation that was generated a year ago at the way some meetings were handled on issues of housing and ADUs. I thought a lot of that was unfair to her because, you know, when you're the president of a meeting, you've got to call time on people because that's how you keep meetings going forward. And it doesn't matter what the topic is, you still have a clock. And so I think some of that stuff was a little bit misplaced, but it drew the irritation out of people to the point where I actually thought that she'd probably draw a challenger.
Well, as somebody who has been in that position and drawn my own ire as a former party vice chair and the exact same thing happened to me, I'd like to think that people were forgiving. But the other thing is that Pinky was a Bernie supporter. And so maybe some of the people who might have been in that, like, let's get progressives in office, see her as a progressive.
Well, and there's that. There is that strain where something happens, people freak out like it's the end of the world on social media, right, and 2 weeks later they don't remember what it was. And I think that's a lot of what this was. There was a villain at the moment, and people have moved on.
Absolutely. So we will be following, of course, the city candidates. I do want to say very quickly that there are also races in Blaine and Birch Bay and all over the place. And there is a special election special filing week for seats where nobody stepped up. And I really encourage you to check those out.
The cemetery districts need you.
Right. Cemetery and Chuckanut, yeah. Forest District, something like, man, you guys asked for that district. You better stand up there and take care of it. But I also wanted to point out really quickly that Ferndale City Council Position 5 has Kathy Watson running against Derek Watson. I don't know anything about them, but oh, God help us all, because it's Watson versus Watson. And it just seems confusing.
You know, it's very interesting. I was thinking about this. When Lori Caskey-Schreiber was on the Whatcom County Council, she actually ran against her brother-in-law. And the way this happened was that they were having at a family dinner or something like this, and her brother-in-law was spouting some things that she objected to, and he'd already filed, and so she went down and filed.
That's
and
great.
So it was a real family feud kind of thing, and I think Lori won the argument.
But we don't know if these Watsons are related.
That's correct.
Yeah. So
that's correct.
We'll hope to find out more, but now it's time, finally, for our ongoing love affair with Bob Ferguson, Attorney General of Washington State, and our Fergie Report. Take it away, Dave.
Well, the biggest news so far this year is, of course, filing a brief with Attorney General Snyderman of New York in support of a student's right to use the bathroom that matches their gender identity in Virginia. And, you know, when I first saw this, I was like, you know, it was a press release from the Attorney General of Washington's office. So I thought, oh, this is going to have like 30 names on it, and maybe I'll find his in there. But he's right up top, right next to Snyderman, and there's some other ones down below. But it was really nice to see a full-throated support of equality from our Attorney General and in a really public way.
And especially when we have yet another initiative attacking that issue and attacking bathroom safety in our own state.
And this is in front of the Fourth Circuit, which was one of the first to make marriage equality the law of their land, which is Maryland to South Carolina. And so that was very good to see. Some big successes for the Attorney General, this year through the legislature, got a special category of law of crime created that is theft of a vulnerable adult. So stealing from seniors or people who need assistance care is its own category of crime now. Another law made a special category of no contact order, so that people who are victims of human trafficking or similar crimes don't have to get a domestic no contact order. They can get a special one that does not, by law, imply a relationship with the person that was abusing them. Big news with his office, not him, going after the Spokane County Democratic Party and the King County Democratic Party for huge PDC violations, like just some jaw-dropping stuff. And he's had to recuse himself because he took endorsements from those folks. But those came from his office.
But it also goes to show that he's not just some sort of progressive wingnut, and that he and his office are upholding the office.
That is, that's the irony of the Attorney General's role, is that they defend the laws of the state of Washington, whether they agree with them or not. And, you know, we saw our last Attorney General, who was kind of conservative, going after these things. And if you can't handle it yourself, you've got a staff of people that can handle it. But that is the role of the AG, or one role, is to defend the laws that the public wants.
So it's been a good year for Attorney General Ferguson so far, and I look forward to talking more and more about how much I love Bob Ferguson as time goes on.
Do you love Bob Ferguson?
I love Bob Ferguson.
Have you met him?
I have met him briefly. Yeah, I didn't get a chance to talk to him, but I've shaken his hand. Yeah,
I think there might be a national role for him at some point.
I do too. I hope so.
Well, I have certainly said, and I don't make endorsements. We're a nonprofit organization, but I would endorse Fergie for King of Washington State. If we ever go that route, if we ever secede, I'm ready to make him king. But Barry, you've been in the political realm for decades, ever since I've been here in the 90s. And so you've been through a succession of attorney generals. This seems really out of character in a good way, but it seems really out of character for a Washington attorney general.
It does. We've never had anybody be this outgoing and taking on big issues nationally. You know, when he took on the travel ban, I have never been so proud of a Washington politician in my life. But then Inslee was right behind him, and you know, our governor is a great governor as well. So, you know, I'm very, very impressed with Bob.
So do you think it's the man? Do you think it's the times, or both? That's the question to the table.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, this is perfect circumstances for someone to really step up. And it's a good opportunity to step up and take a leadership role. And there is a vacuum of that. Nationally, it feels like there are a lot of slots we could fill with strong, committed leaders. And it's nice to see that coming from Washington.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And we hope to share more Fergie love on future shows. So we are about to wrap up, but we wanted to touch on very briefly the Supreme Court rule on gerrymandering in North Carolina. And what happened was that there was a charge of gerrymandering because of race, and so that those districts were not upheld because it was found that in North Carolina a preponderance of people of color were put into districts, which hampers voting and hampers equality of voting.
Yeah, and it was – a lot of people expressed a lot of surprise at the fact that Clarence Thomas – voted with the liberals on this to strike down this districting scheme. And really, I think this is perfect Clarence Thomas. He's there because he's the guy who says anything that has anything to do with race is therefore not permissible. If you use race as a criteria, not okay. And he's been very consistent.
I think the thing that kind of struck me about this is this particular issue is computers and the and the way that computers can draw districts. I mean, they can process information, millions of times, and so using computers, you can gerrymander these districts to the point where it's really unbelievable. I mean, it's beyond human ability and comprehension. And I think that the Supreme Court seems to understand that there's a new factor here beyond just political machination, but you can actually use machine machination to draw profoundly unfair districts. I mean, I think the original North Carolina judge just said that this was like an unbelievable example of how you would draw a district to favor a particular racial outcome.
So there's an app called Maptitude, and the way that it drills down into not just voting records, but all of the data of people, they're shopping, the things that they purchase, and what that does is helps micro-target so that it's not the same districting that it was, say, in the year 2000.
Right. Mm-hmm. And I guess the point I would make is, we're fortunate in Washington State because there was a voter initiative that created a districting commission. So there's a lot of these states, it's done by the legislature and the legislature alone. And so the party in power is in control. And that's unfortunate for a lot of states because you not only have these people in control, but they get to decide how these districts are drawn, their own districts included in that. And in Washington State, we do have that, a little buffer that helps.
You absolutely need that independence.
And you have been listening to Cascadia News Now here on KMRE. I want to thank our fabulous producer, Stephanie Contreras, Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson, and Councilman Barry Buchanan, our engineer, Devlin Sweeney. And we're going to be going out tonight on a song by Rob Quist, who is star of tomorrow's big election in Montana, All Eyes on Montana, about 7 o'clock local time. This has been Cascadia News Now on KMRE.
When I'm down and I'm feeling blue, all I gotta do is sing about you and the way you walked into my dreams. I don't wanna live without you, it's just the way I feel about you. Our love is like my 501 jeans. Won't come apart at the seams, won't be fading in time. And you know I'll never leave you hanging on the line. Well, it's a blue jean love affair, and me and you the perfect pair. Our love is like my 501 jeans. Way high 501 jeans. Below the belt, off the cuff, sometimes gentle, sometimes tough, the way you always seem to look brand new. Don't wanna fool with all the rest, overstated and underdressed, and they could never get a leg up on you. Cute as a button, and you're always on the fly. The way you are forgiving when I don't measure up to size. The way you feel against my skin, you got me thinking about moving in. Our love is like my 501 jeans. It won't come apart at the seams, it won't be fading in time. And you know I'll never leave you hanging on the line. Well, it's a blue jean love affair, and me and you the perfect pair. Our love is like my 501 jeans.